This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, I'm Matthew Kempen, Marketing Manager for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health. Today I'm joined by Dr. Dennis Ugreen, consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist who works at the Maudsley Hospital in London and is a lecturer at King's College London. Hello, Dennis.
Hello.
Dennis, first off, I understand that you've recently been elected editor-in-chief of our journal, Child and Adolescent Mental Health. You must be very excited to take on this role.
I am extremely excited about this. I think it's a wonderful journal. It has been for many years. It's one of these journals that I actually used to read, as opposed to just flick through. And I'm very excited about the opportunity to improve it even further. So there are things that I have in mind. I'm really looking forward to the readership expanding, checking out some of my ideas. In a nutshell, what I want the journal to do is to become the primary source of knowledge and education for all of us who work with young people, for clinicians, and also for those of us who are responsible for policy and for education. So in summary, I would say that CAM, as I see it, should be this wonderful source of education for most of us. And I really want to publish things that are seriously and really clinically relevant. So obviously we have loads of journals that are responsible for research. Some of this research is quite hard to comprehend and is dense with all kinds of stats that many clinicians don't particularly understand. But there are also papers that are really clinically relevant, and I would really want to focus on that, on those ones. So I would like CAM to be the source of the most clinically relevant knowledge that exists.
And can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you come to specialize in suicide and self-harm?
Well, I was born in Ukraine, actually in Soviet Union at the time, which was a country that some of you may have different views on. But one of the things that was there was really quite a punitive use of psychiatry in general. So it was used, amongst other things, to suppress dissidents and to advance the cause of communist regime. Now, that was a fascinating area, and I, over the years, I've met people who were both victims of this, but also people who fought it. For example, the current president of the Ukrainian Psychiatric Association, called Dr. Semyon Gluzman, was one of these people who stood up to the system, and believe me, that wasn't easy. Now, as I understood more about psychiatry, and I realized how important this is, and in fact, if you think about children and young people dying, then the second leading cause of death in most Western countries is suicide. It's not cancer, it's not cardiovascular problems, it's suicide. It's something that really is one of the biggest killers of our young people in all countries. And so I always say to medical students that, you know, to make a difference, you don't have to necessarily do neurosurgery or other things that some of them really consider to be the lifesavers. You really have to concentrate on things that are common, that kill young people. And suicide is one of these things. One of the top three in most countries in the West. And so really my interest, but also self-harm, which is the most the strongest predictor of suicide that we know of, is something that is rising and is very common, and all of us have to see it at some point. And so really the interest in child mental health is that most of psychiatric disorders begin in early years, and suicide and self-harm is something that really is quite a it's probably one of the most important things that exist as far as child and adolescent mental health is concerned. And so dealing with this and targeting that is something that I think is a very worthwhile endeavor.
I understand that you work around borderline personality disorder. Can you explain to the listeners a little bit about what your work entails?
Well, borderline personality disorder is a somewhat contentious still, I'm afraid, diagnosis in young people. It is less contentious in adults, but it is really, in a nutshell, characterized by instability. Emotional relationship instability, instability of the view the young people have of themselves. And to some extent, many of these things are natural in adolescence, to some extent. But of course, borderline personality disorder is something that could be a very painful condition for both the person who has it and for people around the person. And self-harm is something that is very commonly associated with borderline personality disorder. Now, one of the targets of my research work up to date has always been preventing borderline personality disorder in adulthood. And here, child mental health professionals are in a unique position because we do see young people from quite early age. And more importantly, we sometimes also work with adults who are really in, who have personality disorders themselves, but who also have very early interactions with their children. And I think that's something that is a very exciting area. One of my large research grants at the moment with Professor Helen Minnis from Glasgow is looking at looked after children who are at a very great risk of personality disorders and self-harm and suicide, in fact, and looking at, can we do something very early in life of these young people, of these children, to prevent them developing a range of difficulties, of which borderline personality disorder is one of them.
So can you explain a little bit more about the work that you do with Dr. Helen Minnis?
Yes. So the work that we do with the Glasgow University is really one of the most exciting pieces of research that I've ever done, and we are currently doing this. In the UK, there's a relatively small number of children who are looked after, perhaps around 0.1% of all kids. But they account for something like 8% of all suicides in young people. And that's the, you know, the odds are really astronomical. But suicide and self-harm, which is also very common in these young people, is only one aspect. No matter what you look at, if you look at incarceration, unemployment, educational difficulties and so on and so forth, they really are the most vulnerable group of kids that we have in the UK or in any other country. Now, one of the things that we know very well is that the earlier you intervene, the better the outcome. Our work with Glasgow University is looking at a very intense mental health intervention very early in these children's lives. So we are working with 0 to 5 year olds. And we are testing in a randomized study a very intense and very expensive intervention based on the work of Charlie Zena in New Orleans and very generously funded partly by the NSPCC. And we are looking to see if intervening very early and very intensely in these children's lives, 0 to 5 year olds, whether that makes a difference, both in the short term, by which we mean 2.5 years, but also we hope to follow these children for a long time and see what impact that has in the long term. And of course, if that intervention proves to be beneficial, which obviously be helpful, but there are no guarantees, it may not be, then it could become a real game changer, not just for the UK, but for everywhere, because we will know that intervening early, even though it's expensive and resource intensive, could bring about a major benefits over many years. Equally, if we find that there is no difference, or the difference is not very significant or not very cost effective, then that would also be important, because then we would be able to say, look, we need to do something different. Don't do this. This is really expensive and intense.
And if people wanted to find out more about this study, where could they search out this?
Well, they could search Google. Other search engines apparently are also available, although I don't know what they are anymore. And if they just put best, B-E-S-T, with a question mark, and R-C-T, then they will be able to find information about this.
That's fascinating. That's really exciting. I also understand that you're the chief investigator of a controlled trial of supported discharge service versus treatment as usual in adolescents admitted for inpatient care. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Well, that's something that really takes us all the way to the other side of the spectrum. So the work that we do with Professor Minnis looks at 0 to 5 year olds, really very little children. Supported discharge service study looks at older teenagers, the ones that we have to admit for inpatient care. And the idea of that RCT was comparing usual inpatient care with early discharge with the support of intensive community treatment service. And what we have found in that RCT was that if you compare usual inpatient care to intensive community treatment, then within 6 months, you really find very little differences when you look at a range of clinical outcomes, with a few exceptions. Firstly, we have found that young people who are looked after by an intensive community treatment service have much better chances of going back to their community school. So the difference was 80% with the intensive community versus 50% in usual care. And secondly, we have found that children and young people who were discharged early with intensive community treatment had significantly less risk of having multiple self-harm episodes. And that, I think, is important because we have known anecdotally for many years that keeping children in hospital for a long time is probably detrimental to their self-harm. But now we have proof, we have evidence of that. And it's something that policymakers should really take notice of. And I'm very glad that NHS England and Dr. Andy Cotker in particular are really keen to explore this further and to see how they could use this data in their policymaking. Now we're looking at some, we published this in the Lancet Psychiatry, and we're looking at some secondary outcomes as well. Hopefully we'll be reporting soon, and also we will try to look at these differences in the longer term and see what difference, if any, we could find, say, 2 years down the line, 5 years down the line.
And could you tell us about your work on modular psychotherapeutic interventions for self-harm?
Yes, well, that's another, in some ways it's like the middle ground. So we were looking at early interventions for 0 to 5 year olds, the most severe young people who have to be admitted for inpatient care. This is really targeting standard family therapy doctors, standard GP referrals into camps, the tier 3, the standard community services. So the numbers of these referrals has increased and has been increasing almost exponentially in the last few years. And I mean, that's not even talking about the community prevalence, which probably is also rising, especially in teenage girls. Now, the question here was, and still is, so when you have young people referred with self-harm to a standard community service, well, what do you do with them? The numbers are huge, and resources are limited. So the idea here was that everybody who comes in gets therapeutic assessment, which is really quite a brief tool designed to engage young people. And then the idea here was, depending on the severity of self-harm and the finding of therapeutic assessment, young people had to receive one of three possible interventions. So the idea was that for the least severe, perhaps the ones with no mental health diagnoses, we wanted to test something called solution-focused therapy, which is a wonderful brief and similar to coaching. For the most severe ones, we wanted to test a therapy called mentalization-based therapy for adolescents, really designed for children with personality disorders. And then for the majority of the young people who have typically anxiety, depression, other emotional difficulties, we wanted to test CBT, so cognitive behavior therapy. And we've just completed a pilot looking at this sort of three-pronged approach. It'd be fair to say that we haven't published it, so I can't really give all of the details, but it seems that CBT seems to be the most promising way forward for standard community treatment service.
So we're delighted to have Dennis present a masterclass on self-harm with us on Friday the 23rd of November. Dennis, can you explain about what the day will consist of?
Yes, so therapeutic assessment is an intervention that has been designed by my research group years ago and has been implemented to some extent in many different settings, in different countries as well, especially in Germany, I have to say. The idea is that when a clinician sees a young person who comes in emergency with self-harm, typically what happens is you are mandated to take a history, do a risk assessment, and then decide whether the young person is safe to go home or not. A therapeutic assessment takes the assessment one step further. So the idea here is not just to do the basic assessment, but also to try to understand self-harm. And the way that we do it in therapeutic assessment is we create a diagram which the young person really tells us each step of. And then that diagram represents how the young person understands their self-harm. Typically it's about what kinds of difficulties precede self-harm, what kind of negative thoughts and cognitions the young person experiences before self-harm, what is good about self-harm, so what drives self-harm, and what is not so good about self-harm, and how that, what isn't good about self-harm, feeds back into the negative thoughts and experiences of the young person. So understanding self-harm is one part of this. And during the masterclass, we will try to work with the audience in creating these diagrams, and everybody will have a go at it. We have some video materials that will facilitate that. The second part of therapeutic assessment and of the masterclass will be looking at how we could effectively break these vicious cycles. We will look at least two or three ways to do it, which are based on evidence-based interventions. So we will look at how we could use techniques from problem solving, CBT, and solution-focused treatment in breaking the cycle and allowing the young person and the family to see how, post this initial assessment, there is a realistic way forward. So one of the key things about therapeutic assessment is understanding self-harm, showing that it doesn't have to go into these in these vicious cycles, instilling hope for the future and inviting them to come back for more treatment.
So thanks, Dennis, for your time. For those people that are interested in the Self-Harm Masterclass, you can find more details on the ACAM website, which is www.acamh.org. And please follow us on Twitter at ACAMH. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.